Welcome to Straight Talk on Health with Dr. Vincent Medici. Knowing that ultimately it's God who does the healing, Dr. Medici acts as the maestro, orchestrating a person's health through right timing and right therapies, using traditional, natural, alternative, and spiritual practices. Dr. Medici says it's time for people to wake up to their innate potential to heal and to be given a doctor who can orchestrate that healing. Dr. Medici is currently working toward his PhD in biochemistry at Long Beach University and is a licensed chiropractor with additional study in acupuncture, kinesiology, and quantum medicine. He's the curriculum director of the Santa Monica Shiatsu School and the clinic director at the Premier Center in Santa Monica, where he treats many famous names in Hollywood under nationally recognized Premier Labs owner and CEO Dr. Robert Marshall. Got a health question? Ask Dr. Medici live today on Straight Talk on Health. And now, here's Dr. Medici.
Good morning. We're going to talk about medical diplomacy today. By the time this show is over, your experience with your medical doctor, your surgeon, is going to be far more efficacious, smoother, elegant, filled with a lot more love and respect. But you have to learn the language, which you don't know, and that's why there's tension. I've analyzed this as a doctor over two decades. Patients coming in saying, my doctor this, my doctor that, my medical doctor this. Most of it's unnecessary. So you're going off your cholesterol drug, or you cut down on your blood pressure med because the herbs that you just paid for claim to lower your blood pressure, or the vitamin K in your green smoothie and the Coumadin, the blood thinner you're on, are contraindicated. And you're on your way to see your medical doctor, and you know he's going to scold you, and you're scared, deride you. He's going to tell you you're a fool in so many nice words, and that you're wasting your money, and that he's the doctor, and he's going to tell you what you are going to do, and not the other way around. Furthermore, he knows more about you in that 10-minute office visit, if you're lucky, than you know about yourself, which is another reason why you better yield, or he won't treat you anymore, and then what are you going to do? People are so susceptible to these kinds of scenarios because from day one, we're taught that the men in white are infallible, that they can't possibly be wrong. After all, we all wanted to get into medical school, but we didn't because we weren't smart enough, and so we shouldn't argue with someone that's smarter than us, even if they're telling us to do something that is quite positively insane. You may laugh, but that's what's going on in your head as you cave into the pressure, or it's family pressure. You come from a family of large sheep. And as we all know, sheep follow sheep, even if it's off the side of a mountain. Your sister, she had cancer. She cut off the entire breast. And just to make sure, she cut off the other breast. And just to make sure, she took out the ovaries since the breast cancer was estrogen receptive. Now, you have this little lump, and why don't you just do the same thing as your sister did, since your sister loves you, and so does her oncologist, who is now your oncologist. So why don't you just do the same thing? You don't want to be the black sheep, even though you don't want to castrate yourself from fear of breast cancer. So you, in the most vulnerable moment of your life, confide in your oncologist. You get teary-eyed only to realize that you're inside the mouth of the lion and that the standard of care must prevail at all costs, for your own good, of course, because everyone from your sister to your oncologist to the hospital to the surgeon really loves you. I'm not exaggerating. I am not. I hear it all week. Last week, off the line, a lovely Hispanic woman off the show last week, 87-year-old husband with prostate cancer, and that hospital wants to cut out his prostate gland. She's on the phone with me saying, thank you, they are not going to touch his prostate gland over her dead body. They are not going to cut his prostate gland. And I applaud her, and I agree with her. And I would be glad, mind you, to disagree with her if I thought he needed the surgery. So how about a little common sense? You're strong enough to get to be 87 years old, and you get a cancer that much current medical research doesn't even want to call a bona fide cancer anymore, that takes a long time to metastasize, that's in a man already strong enough to make it to 87, and then in all likelihood, it's going to take 5 to 10 years for it to metastasize if it spreads at all. I have dozens of cases like this, and I'm constantly listening to my patients fret over these office visits. And the point is, you don't have to fret or worry or argue or have anxiety most of the time. What you have to do is learn a little medical history. You have to study your illness, and you can. And then you have to learn medical diplomacy. So, Medici did tidbits on medical diplomacy for today's show. First of all, you have to understand what we mean by the standard of care. The standard of care in medicine is what the doctor is told to do by his superiors, his medical board, which can vary from state to state. Abortion, for instance. The American Medical Association also. Indirectly, even the FDA. It means that once he or she takes the Hippocratic Oath, which is the oath you take to be a good doctor, to help a fellow patient means following that standard of care. This is drilled into your head ad infinitum. What your board says is what you do. Then you have to understand what has happened to doctors and the standard of care for a whole lot of reasons that you as the patient don't know about and therefore don't respect or take into account unless you've got the inside track. So, you know, we've got to go back, believe it or not, to Bill and Hillary, who ran the White House. So we're talking the early mid-90s when bad things started to happen to really good doctors. I was there. I was at the meetings. I had a ton of friends who were MDs. I felt for them. I trusted them. I referred to them. I watched them go nuts in the early 90s. The entire financial framework through which they earn their salaries changed drastically. And I attended lots of meetings back then with friends who were medical doctors, good, hardworking, honest medical doctors, and there were lots of them. I attended these meetings where physicians were trying desperately to resist this new evolving financial framework because it was destroying their salaries, amongst many things. Internists, good internists, working hard, 10-year veterans, 15-year veterans, earning $500,000 a year, living a comfortable life, feeling respected and loved, have their salaries cut to $150,000, $200,000 gross if they were lucky. And then medical deductions under the new structure were very hard to come by as private sector medicine corporatized. This is when the HMOs that were already around, like Kaiser, expanded, where the physician became accountable for the first time in that profession for the amount of money they spent, really accountable, even to the point where they were rewarded when they spent less on testing than the other guy. And this collectively devastated a whole lot of good old-fashioned medical doctors who were willing to think outside the box. My medical doctor just doesn't think straight. He doesn't listen. He doesn't have any brains. He doesn't do this. I don't know where he is. He's not home. They used to be home. We had a different and better system back then. And these guys were in a much better position, and they had much more autonomy, more income, and they could think outside the box. He felt better because he wasn't owned by the corporate bean counters, the frugal, the fiscally conscious, as they like to be called, who were suddenly calling the shots. And I'll tell you straight, a lot of the brains went out of medicine. And if you studied the college campuses, it wasn't long before families figured out that if their kids were bright, they just might be better off studying economics rather than medicine. And there were these dramatic shifts out of medicine, let alone PhD-oriented grad school. No one wants to do that. And a flooding of students into computer science, engineering, and most of all, economics. Remember, this is the roaring 1990s, right up into the mid-2000s when you just charge it. We had all this financial expansion off so many things that it paid then for the intelligent choice to go out of medicine, which was being devastated, and into that free money of what we thought, well, we thought it was free money, the 90s, and into 2005 until we crashed. So collectively, medicine doesn't draw the best and the brightest today. And that's the truth. Not like they used to. And I know I got a lot of friends of mine that'll stand right next to me now and agree. It's a different breed in medical school. And that would make sense because medicine is not as sweet a deal as it used to be. The older doctors in their 60s, the guys that I go to, trapped to a certain point. and they've become cynical because they've been disrespected, and they have. And the corporatization of medicine, which has resulted, now here's the point, in a very strict, tight standard of care, leaves many medical doctors anxiety-ridden because, and they tell me this all the time, I got to spend more time following rules and stupid regulations instead of thinking about my patients and outside the box. You got to keep these things in mind. And then you burst in on them in your with your unproven herbal solution for your favorite health concern. And you're not thinking about this. If your medical doctor gets tied to, in any way, your decision to go off, say, your blood pressure meds, and you go home and have a stroke, he or the company he represents will be sued for advising a therapy outside their standard of care. It's the standard of care you're going to hear me repeat through the whole show. It is taking the creative, outside-the-box physician and killing him. So in these cases, what do you think common sense dictates for him when you, the civilian, ask him if he thinks you should go off your meds? Or if you tell him you're going off your meds, and then we get his bruised ego involved, which is already bruised. See, this is how you get the worst side of him, if you get aggressive in ways you don't even know is aggressive. But then, of course, there's the problem. You're also going to get the worst side of him if you stay meek and don't negotiate the standard of care. Okay, one golden rule in negotiation for you herbal people. Do not tell your medical doctor you are seeing a nutritionist who is giving you some sort of supplement related to your health concern, and you just want his approval. You just want him to know. Like he's not going to, inside himself, just laugh. He thinks you're crazy. He's sure you're wasting your money. Even if he's smiling and being nice. Okay, if he is, a lot of times they're not. He's sure you're making a mistake because everything he represents is, I only suggest and advise and counsel what's in my standard of care. Now, I know why you told him. You told him because he knows, in your mind, in your delusional mind, he knows whether or not that supplement or herb is contraindicated to the drug he wants to put you on or that you're presently on. So let me tell you something. Your medical doctor does not know any more about your herb or your supplement than you do. You're asking someone who cannot tell you the answer. You're also asking someone who really doesn't know how the pharmaceutical drugs he puts you on really work. He only knows they do work. And you want to know? He's got a lot on his hands, and that's all he's got time to know, how to functionally apply the medicine, not be a biochemist. You see, but all in all, that doesn't stop the amount of fatal interactions between pharmaceutical drugs to rival just about any significant cause of death each year. And definitely an infinitely greater number than the number of problems caused by interactions between herbs and drugs, which is so rare, which is so exaggerated. And if you get into the research and the data, you'll see that. If taking a natural cure was that dangerous, wouldn't a good doctor ask you? Don't you think it would even be in the standard of care at this point? But they don't. And there's a reason for that. 99.999% of the time, it's never a problem. Herbs are forgiving. Now, a smart doctor, a diplomat, will tell you, Mrs. Smith, I do not really know whether this herb will help you or hurt you. It's not my expertise. So I'm going to stay on the side of caution in your best interest and say no, do not take the herb. And they should say it like they mean it, and that they would tell you if they did know. But that's not your experience when you broach this issue with medical doctors. Between your mixed aggression and anxiety, their bruised egos, it's a flop. Now, if you're taking herbs and you know they help you, you simply point out to your doctor that since your blood pressure is lower, your blood sugar is less, you have less heart palpitations, you have less headaches, less joint pain, less tremors, fewer seizures, lower cholesterol and a better diet, that your blood is thinner because of dietary changes, and that you really want him to lower the dose of the drug incrementally. Not cold turkey, not doc, I'm going off these drugs because they're no good for me. It's doctor, I'm showing signs that are measurable. or at least subjective, but I'm a sane guy. I make money like you. I have a business. And I'm telling you, I think we can lower this drug incrementally. You say it like that. Vast majority of doctors will say, okay, we can try. Because nobody's liable then. You're not doing anything particularly dangerous then. You reduce a dosage of a drug by 10 to 15%. Drugs are forgiving to a certain point. But you never, ever go cold turkey on a drug. You decrease the drug gradually under medical supervision. I have people all the time, hey, Dr. Medici, I just want to go off my blood pressure meds. Don't you think that's a good idea? It's not a good idea. It's a terrible idea. It's medical negligence to advise you to do that. You go to your medical doctor and you finesse it. If you want your doctor to agree to lower the dosage of a drug, tell him, Doc, I'm concerned about the side effects. I don't feel very well on the drug. And it's not helping me that much anyway. Can't we just lower the dose incrementally? And if I don't lose anything, then there's nothing lost. I'm just taking less of a drug that's not making me feel that good, that you insist I should be on, okay. But if I don't lose anything by lowering the dose, then what's to lose? That's a very different argument to a medical doctor. And you will find if you use these languages, the vernaculars, okay, your doctors will be glad to accommodate you. You just have to show them their respect. So here's another tidbit. Bring your doctor a gift, a card, a smile, a box of chocolates. Tell him you referred him a patient. Refer him a patient. If you're in that mill type of situation, those bad Kaiser Permanentes, not the good ones, but the bad ones or whatever it might be, and you feel like you're just a number, do things like that. They're little things. They make a huge difference because nobody does that. Absurd, but it works. You don't know this, but your doctor's just as vulnerable as you are. Guarantee you that. Don't go into this session ready to show him how informed you are. How you are not the type of patient that just bows down to a person in a white coat. How you are well aware of the dangers of drugs and surgeries. How you have done your research over the years and studies show blah, blah, blah. Patients always think they're going to get better care this way. You see, or they're going to get more cooperation from their doctor. It doesn't work that way. That is a counterproductive stance. Another tidbit. Patients always say, my medical doctor doesn't answer my questions. Well, my advice to you the next time you have an office visit is to type your questions onto paper. Have the questions be clear, brief, concise, and do not have more than three or four in a visit. You know, I realize as I'm explaining these to you guys, it almost sounds like I'm scolding you. I apologize. I'm not. I'm starting to, you know, imagine myself in the same position, which often I am in a different way. So this is not scolding. This is just to give you the inside track. Have those questions be brief, clear, concise. And don't put more than three or four questions on one page. I have people coming in. People do this to doctors all the time. You come in with 20 questions all typed up. You can't do that. You especially can't do that with a medical doctor. And the other thing, if you ask him if you can record the session, okay, and you expect him to speak freely on sensitive topics, he's going to say yes, and then he's going to guard everything he says because you have him on tape. That's common sense. Medical doctors in the system are in a very litigious system, and they have to protect themselves, and they will. Doctors classify patients. You may not know that. You have the attitude, maybe doctors just don't care. It may really surprise you. Your doctors talk about their patients all the time. They probably talk about their patients to other doctors and to their staff more than they talk about anything. And they try to protect themselves with their nurses, secretaries, office receptionists, and everyone working in the office. So please understand that as a patient, you are classified in an amazingly creative number of ways. And the front desk is the first line of command. And they naturally act as guard dogs to protect the doctor. So you kind of make friends. You may take a little bit of abuse the first visit. There's lots of offices that run that way, and you're just being tested. They're going to be tough in the beginning because they want to know you're going to comply. They want to know if you're going to be a problem. You may take a little heat in the first visit, but once you get a good rating, once you're on the inside, you can start being vocally diplomatic at getting what you want in that relationship. For instance, the more invasive testing that their medical corporation does not want to give you. If you're asking for the MRI, the CT scan, and you're only getting the X-ray, if you're only getting the drug but not the diagnostic test, continue to insist that the pain is worse than ever and you need the more advanced diagnostic test. The same thing applies when you want the bacteria cultured because you have some weird infection. Do not say that the pain is still there. Don't say that. You must say that the pain is worse. You have to say the pain is worse. The magic word is the pain is worse. That means you did what they said. You had pain. You did what they said. You went home, and the pain is worse. Not the same, worse. You see, because in the protocol, if you say the pain is worse, it clearly states and means in the most objective sense that the therapy didn't work. And so it's a lot more difficult then in managed care for them to refuse to escalate the diagnostic protocol. Another good rule of thumb when getting a second opinion: do not tell the doctor you've been to his friend down the street or some other doctor. This one takes a lot of finesse, and you'll see what I mean in a moment. You go to a doctor, you get an opinion, you're not happy with the opinion. Not because it's just hard to hear, but because you just feel the doctor just doesn't care. He didn't get it. He wasn't experienced with the case. And just in your gut, there's just something wrong about the diagnosis. So you want to go to a second doctor. Now, the minute you tell a doctor about the prior rendered opinion, or that you've seen another doctor, let alone in the same neighborhood, he's going to be more cautious and more likely to back up the first opinion. Doctors, again, taught to protect themselves, and this is a certain way they'll do it. So if you tell them or put them in a position where they have to disagree with a colleague, you're going to scare them. If you can avoid that, don't scare them. Then there's the issue with the second opinion because your insurance won't pay for it. Okay? Pay it out of pocket and then go to the best. That's tough to hear. People hate that. Why should I pay? I'm going to give you some real good reasons why you should pay a doctor cash if you can't get your insurance to pay. But just a moment. First, we talk about the doctors you go to who should have fairly busy practices. So I'm talking about now your decision to go to a private sector doctor if your insurance won't let you go outside their care. If it already does, and that's the kind of insurance you should have, great. So either way, take this as a rule of thumb. Go to a doctor who has a fairly busy practice, not a mill, and not a guy that sits there all day. Both those extremes are not good signs. Doctors love to do that all the time. They make the office super busy. They pack people in, this, that, the other thing. They think it gives them a good profile. It basically shows them that they're budgeting things to the second, and that's not the best sign. Doctors that spend a lot of time with their patients. So it may be crazy, it may be insane, but once you get in there with the doctor, they're going to spend a lot of time. You're not going to feel like you're being shorted. And then look for doctors that deal with the kinds of patients that could afford very expensive malpractice attorneys if it was necessary to do so. That's right. That's a good sign. An upwardly mobile clientele of intelligent people who make their livings surviving and prospering in business because they're way less likely to be intimidated and abused. When you make five times the amount of money than the medical doctor you're talking to, it's very hard to be intimidated, especially if you're a good 10 to 20 years older than your medical doctor. So you look for offices that cater to those types of people. Very, very important. That doctor should be loved by his staff, who should at least have one or two people in that staff. Remember, this is transient California, but there should be at least one or two people in the staff that have worked with the doctor from 5 to 10 years. There should not be a lot of tension in the environment. There may be chaos, okay? Doctors' offices are chaotic. They're not accounting firms, okay? Doctors' offices can be chaotic, but the chaos should not be with tension, you see? If the doctor looks tired, he's probably working too hard and cares too much, which is exactly, I think, what you want, unless, of course, he's sick. Let me repeat this emphatically. 1 ounce of good diagnostic work is worth 1 pound of therapy. So you're going to slow up the procedure when you feel like you're trapped in your healthcare plan and you can't get a good diagnosis. And if you're not, you're going to do the same thing. You're going to shop around and get multiple diagnoses. Don't say you don't have the money. Consults are affordable. Okay. And diagnostic tests with a good diagnostician will be minimized. So, now this is the tricky part. If the second doctor wants to order the same diagnostic test that you just had, you may then have to spill the beans by producing that same diagnostic test, which means you brought your copies. And explaining, and this is the key, you're going to explain that you saw a good doctor already, but in the managed care system. And these guys are just so busy, and they don't talk to their patients, and you want the best. Now, there are certain types of very successful high-end medical doctors who know exactly what you're talking about, because that's the type of practice they never wanted to have and made sure they didn't have. So they know what you mean. You just got to say it in a loving way, and then you'll get their attention, and then you will proceed smoothly. Or if the diagnostic test is non-invasive, then pay for it a second time and don't spill the beans. Keep the doctor as objective as possible. Point is, and I see this all the time, and this is what's behind this, patients sensing their diagnosis is not accurate and then running to other physicians in the same medical group. Big mistake. And big mistake not to, at all costs, get a precise diagnosis before you're on chronic antibiotics, before 2 to 3 years on chronic antibiotics, because you never took the time to do the hard part of it, or your doctor didn't, or you're given what comes down to exploratory surgeries, or a string of multiple poor evaluations done more cheaply that could have been done correctly the first time, and then in your pain and exhaustion, you make a poor choice. You get mad at yourself because you don't have control. Again, that statement that I made, 1 ounce of good diagnostic work is worth 1 pound of therapy. Now, please understand, when your doctor tells you that a surgery was a success, it means that the surgery was performed correctly. Okay? It doesn't mean more than that. Correctly means efficiently, with minimal side effects, and reasonable recovery rates. It doesn't mean that the symptom was going to go away or that the correct diagnosis was rendered in the first place. This is very confusing to patients. Surgeons do surgeries. They tend, now this is not always true, but they tend to, if they can, move away from a certain type of diagnosis. Okay? Just learning surgery is a massive art form. So just because the surgeon successfully removes the extruded disc or decompresses the spinal cord or removes a gallbladder or reattaches a retina or removes part of an intestine in a Crohn's case or replaces a knee or a hip doesn't mean the pain or even the loss of function is going to go away. And yet to the surgeon, the surgery was a technical success. Remember, the decision to operate is often a joint decision between the surgeon and the diagnostician. So we have the cardiologist and the cardiac surgeon, the neurologist and the neurosurgeon, the neurologist and the brain surgeon. So the surgeon focuses on the art of surgery, and diagnosis can suffer. The patient doesn't make that distinction. That's the problem. Classic scenario. Doctor, you cut me open. You sewed me up. I'm still in pain. Patient, according to the MRI and the scan, the surgery was an absolute success. but doctor, I'm still in pain. And you look at your doctor like, why doesn't he get it? Is there something wrong with him? What you're not getting is you're talking to a surgeon. They are evaluating the efficacy of therapy with different standards. Their standard of care is different than your common sense. Okay, let's take a brief break. We're going to get to the phones in about 10 more minutes, and we'll take it. In case you didn't know, that was Adele. I just had to play that today because I love that song, but also because, you know, recently Adele had to cancel her concert tour because of really bad laryngitis. So I'm going to put it out there. If anybody out there knows her phone number, would you tell her to please call 888-777-0711. 888-777-0711. I am dead serious about this. You know, a woman like this, we want to keep her singing till she's 120, and she's pooping out on us at 23 years old because of laryngitis. I feel I'm the guy for the job, so please put the word out. That's the toll-free number, 888-777-0711, not just for Adele, but for anybody with health concerns that wants their questions answered. And as always, if you call and we don't do it live, I'll always spend at least an hour after the show, which is why I'm late for work every Saturday, answering more questions so I can talk to everyone. And if I still can't get to everyone, which has been happening, you just give us your phone number and your name. You call in next Saturday. By then, we'll know who you are. You're at the top of the list, and I'll definitely speak to you on or off the air. So, across two Saturdays, you can't miss. All right. Next topic. This show is in its 11th week. The response has been fantastic. And I've talked to so many of you who, as far as I'm concerned, need more than 15 minutes on the radio show, more than the radio show can offer. I think you need something very often more comprehensive. So if this sounds like you, if you sense that 15 minutes, even 15 minutes, is not enough, and it's a lot of you, then get on my website, straighttalk.cc, that's straighttalk.cc, and sign up online for a nutritional phone consult on the old-fashioned telephone, or Skype video. I can get a lot done in 1 hour, and I can't imagine anyone needing more than 90 minutes. You save yourself the time and cost of transportation. It's definitely cheaper than an office visit. And if you're listening out of state, as many of you are, it's just the perfect solution. Okay, that's it. A little more Adele, and then back to the show. Okay, we're back. We're back and probably having some technical problems if you heard that. If you'd already called into the show, there were about 8 or 9 callers. Call back. The phone line had gone down for unknown mysterious reasons. Okay, so just call back. We got them running now. All right. Infectious disease. When you go to see an infectious disease specialist or anyone searching for microbes, it's sometimes really difficult to find them because the classic tests are all often just useless. If you've got chronic infection, chronic amoeba, chronic giardia, if you have any acute episode of bacterial or parasitic infection, and ultimately you believe years later you're still somewhat not the same, you're still infected in some weird way, you just got that feeling, you're not going to get diagnosed correctly by the man in the white coat. You know why? There's only one reason. We don't have the technologies. The infections, and we hate to admit this because we're mankind, the infections are ahead of us. They're sneakier. They multiply faster. They trade genes. They adapt without ego. So if you're in this infectious disease problem, you got some weird bug that's kept you down, you got to exert pressure on your infectious disease doctor to create relationship, unless he already has relationship with specialty labs that'll run PCR tests. Now, a PCR test is a test which looks for the microbe by identifying its nucleotide sequence, which will be specific to the microbe. That's as good as we're doing today, as far as standard conservative medicine is concerned. There's tons of energetic tests that'll find anything. I'm not backing those. I could be wrong. I really mean that. But I'm not backing them. I don't feel comfortable with them. Okay? But the PCR tests have been very studied. Kerry Mulis won the Nobel Prize in 92. Well, actually, he invented PCR and took it to the commercial market in the early 90s and recently received the Nobel Prize for it. This is like the forensic testing we do, right? If just if you don't need to touch something for somebody to know that you were there. If a cell of your body falls off, they do what we call that DNA testing. PCR tests are effectively the DNA testing that we search for those microbes we can't otherwise find in your body. So they'll examine all the fluids, the blood, the urine, the saliva, the feces, sexual fluids. You see, but this is how this is still no assurance that if the bug has gone inside the cell, the PCR test may give you a false negative. But it's way better as a rule than anything else they're testing with today. So if you're in this situation where you're certain, maybe some holistic practitioner has told you you're infected some way, shape, or form, and no medical doctor is going to trust their certain diagnostic test, and yet you want that backup, and you should get that backup. Let me go on record and say that to you. You really should 9 times out of 10. Okay, so you're in there with your infectious disease guy after you've been sick for 2 to 10 years, and you're asking him to confirm your suspicion, and you're mentioning this microbe, and the doctor kind of gives you a stupid look, like, you know, you're just out of your scope, patient. This is when you politely suggest, look, I know this is in medicine and this is respected. Do you have any relationship with a PCR lab? And let's run the tests for these 10 microbes, because, doc, I know I'm infected, and you know I've got the symptoms, and something's wrong here. That's the way you say it, you see? So off your clinical history, when your finger points to microbes and you believe you have them, don't get frustrated with your disease specialist. One, they don't have the tools. Number two, PCR is on the way, but it's not necessarily in their standard of care. So you're asking them to go outside approved standard of care or practiced standard of care. It's just a little too new. And this really frustrates people because they're working with their holistic practitioner and they're being told you've got every infection in the world based upon this, that, and the other test. And yet the MD in the end at schools like Stanford and Berkeley and UCLA, great places of learning, are telling you, no, you don't. Well, a lot of times it's because they're not running the test that's on the cusp of their very own standard of care. And you got to get that distinction, guys. When you're talking to doctors and you're reading on the internet about this therapy that medical doctors do, but your medical doctor laughs at it, you got to get medicine, okay? You're always going to have a renegade doctor getting something FDA approved, AMA approved, and they're allowed to do it. And there's lots of different levels in the hierarchy of doctors that are doing that. So there's a distinction between a doctor like that that's got some new way to do a radical prostatectomy to ensure that you are not going to be impotent. There's a big difference between that type of a doctor and one who's effectively in the standard practice of medicine. You see, and if you don't get those distinctions, then in your mind as the patient, hey, my MD should do this because I Googled something after hours of research on the internet for a therapy that other medical doctors do. So what's the problem? Well, that is the problem, and that's my point. Okay. Now, this PCR testing, which is amazing stuff, again, now you're outside normal scope. So it might be tougher unless you really have the cooperation of your doctor to have insurance pay. And these tests can be very expensive. They can be cost prohibitive sometimes. And in the end, they may not make a difference to therapy, you see? But nonetheless, you should do it if you're chronically infected. Because once you identify an infectious agent, when all the tests have understandably failed, you can begin to focus yourself into healing. And it can help tremendously sometimes your medical doctor or whatever practitioner you're with. It's good if you can to know what you're up against. And sometimes it's God's plan. It's his test of faith to fight an invisible enemy. That's up to God. So you got to let go either way. Now, if you do have a good fortune via a fine diagnostic test like PCR, you got something called the Rife machine, Rife machine, R-I-F-E, to homeopathy. And that can launch a very specific attack, more specific than herbs very often, on the microbe. So look up homeopathy. It's designed to lyse the infectious agent vibrationally. That's all I'll say. The Rife machine, once it identifies the microbe, attempts to hit it with a frequency, the same frequency, but the opposite wavelength. Now, practitioners, whether they're doing Rife or homeopathy, 9 times out of 10, they don't know what they're doing. I'm just going to go on record and say that. These guys are hard to find. There's a ton of quacks in the field, okay, of both. But when you get people that really know what a Rife machine is with the cathode ray tube, when you really get a homeopathist, often the English and Germans are the best at that. When you really get an extremely filled one, it can be enormously effective. And you're going to need something enormously effective because microbial medicine has a long way to go because the microbes have had a 4 billion year head start and they have no ego in their adaptation. All right, let's see here. All right. Now, a couple of other notes. Radical prostatectomies. When you are up for a radical prostatectomy and you're looking at impotence, you're looking at urinary incontinence, with that incontinence is loss of sleep and all the consequences of loss of sleep over 5 years. Remember this, the prostatic capsule will resist metastasis. In addition, the prostate cancer of a 60-year-old man is a different animal than the prostate cancer of a man at age 80 or 85. And your doctors will negotiate with you and just monitor it. Even if your Gleason score is high, and especially if your PSA is high. PSA is not very difficult to bring down. Lots of doctors know that very often there is no imminent rush. So don't be told there is one unless someone gives you an extremely good reason. So prostate cancer is one of those slower growing things that may not even be cancer, some of the recent research suggests. And don't get into conflict with your medical doctor. If you have a medical doctor or a surgeon that is forcing a prostatectomy upon you at some sort of prolific speed, really think twice about that, especially if you're in your 80s. Okay, chances are that thing will never metastasize. And if it does, it could be 10, 15 years. Consider that. Discuss that with your medical doctor. Ask him that. See what he says. Okay. Now, one of the toughest things for an orthopedic surgeon to determine is who is going to have chronic pain after a low back or neck surgery. Now, their education, it doesn't allow them really to arrive at an estimate of this. They'll give you a good convincing statistic. Doctor, is my low back pain going to go away after the surgery or neck pain? They can tell you, we've got great statistics here, but that doesn't mean you won't be the unlucky one. You see? And if you are, they don't have a way of knowing ahead of time. So the result of that is that an orthopedic surgeon, especially a neurosurgeon, who, by the way, if you didn't know this, is the preferred surgeon in many low back and neck surgeries, not the orthopedist. Okay? Either way, knowing this, knowing they don't have a good tool to determine who's going to fail, all right, they're both going to be very cautious before cutting. And if you're in acute sympathetic dominance, that's a lot of stress, which is a whole other show, but something we touched on in show number 3, you should be very cautious about a low back or neck surgery. Fusions. Fight fusion at all costs. Doctors know this. This is the last thing they want you to experience. And if you fail a low back or cervical fusion, meaning after the fusion you are still in considerable pain, this is a very, very unforgiving surgery. It's about the only thing I wouldn't tackle after 10 years of being extremely skilled at doing it. Again, after a failed first surgery, your surgeon should be meek, shy at suggesting a second. But the pressure's on him because you're back in pain. So you got to catch the catch 22 here. You're scared because you're still in pain. Your surgeon's not feeling too good about it. He feels indebted to you, and yet there is a guy, and everyone considering neck or back surgery, you get this book, and you know this man. His name is Harold Wilkinson. He's a neurosurgeon out of Boston, spends his time teaching the other neurosurgeons how to do things correctly. He will not teach an orthopedic surgeon. He's into neurosurgeons doing surgery. And he tells us in his book that if the first surgery does not work, the failure rate in the second surgery is around 90%. And that's been my finding also, which should not obscure the fact now that a lot of people get helped tremendously by low back and neck surgeries. It's just the second one you should really think twice about. Okay, that's it for now. I think we're going to go to the phones here, and we'll see what's what. All right. Marilyn from Lakewood, what causes scoliosis and what can be done? Oh, we're going to tackle that one. Hi, Marilyn. It's Dr. Medici. Hi, Marilyn. Dr. Medici. Okay, we just got to make another adjustment because the phones are down. I was going to get into your OBG and childbirth, how you negotiate things with your medical doctor who's going to birth your baby, because we've got a lot to say in terms of cesareans and episiotomies and the fact that a lot of doctors, they just do cesareans and they don't think about it anymore. They don't even wait for you to dilate because you do or you don't. And if you don't, there's nothing they can negotiate with you and your cervix, and there's no midwife there to counsel them. And collectively, then, they're going to just cut. And those cesareans, those scars are wretched. And I'm going to do a show eventually, and I'm going to have to get computer graphics because I'm not totally comfortable now with this scar thing in that I don't really think enough people really understand on the human body what a scar actually is. You see, you see that cut there, and in your mind, you just see a line that we call the scar. But what you don't get is a scar is a three-dimensional animal. It's like where you see your scar, I want you to picture a grapefruit or a cantaloupe, and I want you to drop that grapefruit or cantaloupe deeply into your body till you can't see it anymore. In that circumferential, in a volume, the shape of a grapefruit or a cantaloupe, all your connective tissue is twisted beneath the scar. That's why scars are dangerous. So when you're getting these cesareans and these episiotomies, the reflexes, as Dr. Marshall has explained to you guys so often, the reflexes aren't some magical energetic block. It is a physical twist of connective tissue. It's a physical twist of connective tissue, ensuring you that your veins, arteries, nerves, and muscles and organs are going to get twisted and flipped, okay? Twisted and flipped, so you can't get then what? Drainage from that organ. You can't get infusion of blood into the organ. You can't get nerve supply into that organ. And collectively, you're not going to work. So, when you're in your eighth or ninth month and you got a big baby coming out with a large fat head, and this is number one, you've got to have relationship with your OBG and a thought process that's going to allow that doctor to finesse, even in the presence of a midwife. And midwifery is back, and you have people getting educated in it, and you have midwives. They can be the difference between years of pain, okay, and reflexes. And we also have literature. It was either the New England Journal of Medicine, Joanna got it for me at the office. It was either New England Journal of Medicine or Lancet that stated specifically it was an imperative to doctors. Stop doing the episiotomies. They are not good for women. See, so these things are known. And I think doctors would agree. Nobody wants to cut if they don't have to. But that's the shade of gray then. And if you find your doctor is too quick to do that, if his track record is C-sec, 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 oh, we'll just do a C-sec, don't worry about it, get another OBG. Okay? And it's not that you're going to get the perfect one. This is going to be a dance. You may have to negotiate with them on that basis. That, ladies, is why you have a husband. And hopefully your husband's name is Bruno or the like, because he's got to sit down with a doctor in a rather intense moment and politely and in a professional way say, I'm looking for the type of doctor that's going to, if she does not dilate, we're not going to go straight to C-sec unless it threatens the baby or her life. And you got to vibe it out there. One way to vibe it out is to ask the doctor if they would mind working with a midwife or having a midwife present, or have they ever done that? You do things like that, you get a whole different type of medical doctor. I actually helped birth a baby last summer while somebody was in Hungary with a midwife, and the cord was wrapped around the child's neck. And a day before the birth, because they knew the cord was there, a day before the birth, I was on the phone with the husband, with the mom, and we were coaching to see how we could finesse this with the medical doctor, and they had a midwife, and they pulled it off, and it was beautiful, and it was a 20-hour labor. So there's a lot you have to know about birthing children. You're going to need a husband there, okay? Now, the episiotomy, this is another thing altogether. By the time you need the episiotomy, the baby's on the way out. And the doctor can slit ahead of time. Now, here's the thing. When you slice ahead of time, a razor slice, so to speak, picture that. When it comes time to stitching it up, because the edges of both sides of the skin are not serrated, serrated, I think is the word, like a serrated-edged knife, they don't groove back together as easily. Now, this is counterintuitive. You'd think a tear is going to be worse than a scar with a scalpel. But it's not the case. Any good midwife will tell you that if you slice, you're going to ensure that the tissues are challenged in a much deeper way to ever coming back together again and holding the exact same tone. So you don't want the episiotomy. At the same time, you're going to have a judgment call, and that judgment is going to be about whether or not, if they don't do the episiotomy, if you're going to tear a lot more. So you really got to get the cooperation in there with your OBG just at the right moment. The experience and the testimony of midwife after midwife after midwife, and go find one. There's lots of good ones. Is that if the mom does her homework, tears will be minimal. And I'm going to bring a woman on the show named Ellen Heed eventually, who's worked this way with moms, helping them recover from these things. And she's going to come on, and she'll testify to the fact, as well as I will in my experience, as well as many midwives, that if you go that way, even if you tear, and I mean tear naturally, in the aftermath, you're going to heal up way faster. The episiotomy is dangerous, and one reason it's dangerous is not exactly in the textbooks. That's going to take us to Chinese medicine. Let me simply say this for now, because this is another show. When you tear down there, there are two major lines of energy. One is called conception vessel, which comes up the front of the body. The other is called the governing vessel, which is a magnetic field that runs down the back of the body. And anyone broaching in holistic energetic medicine is familiar with this orbit of energy in this circumferential oblong way, up the belly, down the back, up the belly, down the back. They intersect in two places. One is the top of the head, but the other is in the perineum, right where you tear when you get this episiotomy, or right where you tear when you tear. Either way, when a woman is left torn like that, the hormonal power of the woman is gone, okay, or it's debilitated. And that's what rehab is about, and that's why you have to understand how to negotiate with your doctor to get on the other side of that episiotomy. Okay, it's 10:55. I'm going to wrap it up. Sorry about the calls. We had technical problems, and I'm not going to stress the show. So first, let me say this. I'll be on the line another 60, 75 minutes. So for all you guys that did call in, we got about 12 people here. I'll stay late today. I'll stay 90 minutes, and we'll get the job done. Also, I have 80 students for school now. I got to close it out, guys. I'm sorry. I can't take any more students until I can structure the first 80. We are calling people. If you haven't been called, please be patient. We're talking to everyone personally that signed up. I want to get to know everybody. So I'll get to you soon. And that's it. I'm happy with the show. I hope you're happy. I'm Vincent Medici. This is Straight Talk on Health. Have a great week.
You've been listening to Straight Talk on Health with Dr. Vincent Medici. Invite your family and friends to the show and learn about Dr. Medici through his website, straighttalk.cc. He'll give you the tools you need to save your health and prevent unnecessary surgeries and harmful drugs. And the best part? You can call in live with your health questions every week. For those of you still holding for Dr. Medici, stay on hold. He'll continue to answer calls for as long as it takes. He's dedicated to your ultimate healing. And remember, to contact his office for an appointment, call Rachel or Johanna at 310-320-1132. That's 310-320-1132. Join Dr. Medici next week at 10 a.m. for more Straight Talk on Health. This show and the information therein has not been evaluated by the FDA, and recommended products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The information provided on this site is for informational purposes only and is not intended as a substitute for advice from your physician or other healthcare professional.